Welcome back to Rooted Recovery Stories, or welcome for the first time. I'm Patrick Custer, your host, and I'm so glad that you are here. If you're tuning in, you're meant to be here. Even if it's just, you're like, I'm this one person. What are you saying? Yeah, if this whole show is just for, this one episode is for you, and you're the only one tuning in, I believe that there's intention behind it and you're meant to be here. And we're so grateful that you are listening or watching. So thank you for being here. I'm also so excited to have my guest today, Ruthie Lindsay. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I love that opening. And thank you so much for allowing me to be here. It's such an honor.
Absolutely.
So grateful to share the space with you.
Yeah. I really want to unwrap who you are and all the wonderful, spectacular things about you as we go through. And so, rather than tell everybody beforehand, I want to let you do that.
Great.
And to kick things off in a fun way, you're my second guest that we're going to get to do this with, but,
okay.
I think it's a lighthearted way to get the show started. So I want to do two truths and a lie.
Okay.
About you.
Got it. All right. Two truths and a lie.
I'm really good at guessing, so make it hard.
Okay. I died before. I've died in this life, in this body. I've never been in love before. I've been married, but you know, and, I had a wire pierce my brain.
I'm going to go for the lie is that you've never been in love.
That's actually my truth. No, sorry. That's the lie. I'm in love for the very first time in my life. So yeah. Good job.
Yay.
That,
yay for you being in love and yay for me guessing.
Yeah. I'm actually really impressed because, you know.
Yeah. I love hearing that.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's really, really sweet. I'm really excited and grateful and just didn't know if I'd get to have that experience in this life. So
yeah.
It's really beautiful.
Well, I celebrate that with you.
Thank you.
Among the other things we're going to get to celebrate. But already you have told me some things about your story that are so, so, so deep, right? So you died and you had a wire pierce your brain.
Yeah.
When you say the wire pierced your brain, did it pierce your the dura on the outside, or did it go in and actually touch the brain matter?
It went into my brainstem.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And I'm apparently the only human in the world that's ever had that. And I shouldn't be alive or walking or breathing or have brain functioning.
Air quotes for the radio or for the audio listeners.
Yeah.
So, all right. Where are we starting? Because I know that there is let's rewind just a little bit to the foundation of who you are.
Yeah.
What makes you up?
Yeah. Oh goodness. So much. I mean, you know, there's been quite the journey to get to this place, mm-hmm. but it was all a part of it, you know. I grew up in South Louisiana. I grew up in a really sweet home and with, you know, loving parents that did the best that they knew how, and there wasn't a lot of emotional intelligence, you know, so there wasn't a lot of space for a lot of feelings. I'm a big feeler.
Yeah.
I am off the charts empath, porous, you know, very, very highly sensitive person, and grew up in a house with all boys, and just didn't have tools to know how to handle the big feelings. And so we laugh. I'm like, I kind of was raised on TV and junk food. And it saved me, honestly, you know, and I ended up having a really big journey with disordered eating.
Mm.
And I hated it for so much of my life. But now I can look back and be like, it kept me here. I mean, for so much of my life, I wanted to die and I didn't want to be here. And it was a chance for me to get out of my body and to numb and to not feel. And so I'm grateful for those things that I used at the time, you know.
So when you were numbing with disordered eating, how did disordered eating introduce itself into your life?
Yeah. Well, my mom's like one of the most beautiful women you've ever seen. But the only way I ever heard bodies talked about in my home was if they were skinny or fat. that was really the main reason I ever heard a body spoken of. And so the most important thing was to be skinny and pretty in my home. That was the most, like, that's what gave you value. That's what gave you worth. That's what made you, you know, important. And I think there's, like, you know, I think about with my sweet mom, like, it's hard. There's a weight that comes when you're, like, always the most beautiful person in a room. I mean, my mom was, like, always the most beautiful person. And that's everything that people would talk to her about, is how she's the most beautiful person. And so you become this, you know, you believe that that's your value, that's your worth, that's who you are, as being this beautiful person. And so that causes its own wounding, I would say, especially for women, you know, thinking that's all you have to offer this world. And then me being the only girl, that was definitely transferred onto me. I got asked a lot, what did they say about you today? They say how pretty you were. What they say about your outfit? What they, you know, when I'd come home from school, that was like, and it wasn't necessarily what did they say. It felt very much like, what did the important people, what did the right people say about you? And so I learned from a very young age, my value, my worth is in what the right people say about me. And I need to look a certain way, and I need to be really good and really sweet and really pleasant and really kind and really pretty and gentle. And so I learned how to fold myself up into a lot of, you know, to fit into a teeny, teeny, tiny box that me and God and others had to fit in. And I mean, we made fun of people like me at the dinner table those nights. And I was a part of it because, you know, like, we make fun and mock what we fear. And the unknown is something we fear. And so if you don't fit in that box, it's really easy to mock it and make fun of it because it's different.
Yeah.
Right. And so I learned how to belong. I mean, we're hardwired for belonging. So I did everything I needed to do. I learned from a very young age how to be, you know, very pleasant, and how to get friends, and how to get people to like me. And I knew to smile really big. And I knew if I asked people a ton of questions, they'd ask, they like me. And I realized that at a very, I mean, I remember having that conscious thought in probably like second grade.
Wow.
And then they didn't have to know about me and realize that maybe they didn't like me, and maybe I wasn't so great, and maybe I wasn't so wonderful if I just asked them a lot of questions. So that was kind of the basis of, you know, a lot of foundation for who I was. I didn't have tools to calm my nervous system. There wasn't a lot of attunement or attachment. And so I learned how to kind of leave my body at a very young age and become very popular and liked by everyone. And when I was a senior in high school, I was hit by an ambulance. I pulled out in front of an ambulance driving to Baton Rouge, and he hit me on my car door going about 65. And so I broke 3 ribs. They punctured my lung. My lungs collapsed. My spleen ruptured. I broke C1 and C2 of my neck, and I died.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's wild. I didn't remember much about it for a long time until way later. But he had everything there to save me. Yeah. I was on life support for a long time.
Do they know how long you were dead for?
No.
Really?
Mm-mm, because I didn't even realize that until later, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And my friend in the wreck with me, and I've actually, like, I have like memory of it now through past life regression and things.
Wow.
But my friend in the wreck with me, he said that I was just hanging over the steering wheel and wasn't moving, wasn't breathing, wasn't making any sounds. And then he's like, it could be 3 minutes. It could have been 6 minutes. He didn't actually.
So by the time the emergency people got to you, well, I guess you were hit by that, they were there.
Right.
But by the time you were receiving care, you were no pulse, no breathing.
By the time I was receiving care, I was breathing. All of a sudden, he said, I just started coughing and really, really loud. I just came back. I didn't have to have help in coming back. But
they didn't shock you or anything.
But the thing is, because I had broken my neck and because it was an ambulance driver, he knew how to stabilize me because they didn't know at the time. But if someone had just pulled me out or anything, like, there's no way I'd be walking or, you know, any of that. So he knew to put a neck brace on me to stabilize me and all of those things. And yeah, I was in the hospital for about a month on life, and I was on life support, the whole thing. And back then, when they did spinal cord fusions, they took bone from your hip and then they wrapped it with wire. And that's what they used back then. And they don't use wire anymore because wire can break. And so I, you know, left the hospital, had a big neck brace. I wore it for probably like 5 or 6 months. I was able to literally go back to school. It happened on my dad's birthday, November 2nd of my senior year in high school. I just turned 17, like probably 2 weeks before. I'd been like homecoming queen, you know, just had all of this like life in front of me.
Yeah.
And then here I was, you know, fighting for my life. Mm. And I left the hospital with a big neck brace with a, you know, less organs and a little more wire in my body. And I kind of went back to life as normal, weirdly enough. I had no tools. I had no understanding of trauma in the body or disassociation. Mm-hmm. And I plastered a big old smile on my face and went back to kind of life as normal. I didn't have a whole lot of residual effects at the time in terms of physical pain. Obviously, I was carrying all the trauma in my body, but had no tools for it. And I was already pretty disassociated before that had happened. And that just sent me way further out. My eating disorder came way strong after that because it was my one little sense of control. You know, I would starve myself, which later moved into binging. But I graduated on time, went to college. No one would have known, you know, again, very popular, made a ton of friends. I would just
You're doing all the things that made mom and especially mom proud.
Oh, yeah. Knew how to, you know, have a permigrin, made a ton of friends. And I was either starving myself, binging, watching a lot of TV. And when I was alone, just had this very numb. I didn't cry for about 7 years.
Ooh.
Yeah. I just cut myself off. I learned how to not feel, which I am like the biggest feeler ever. I learned how to numb it. I learned how to stuff it. And because I was a good Christian girl, I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't do any drugs. Mm-hmm. I didn't have sex. But my thing was food and screens. And then I moved to Nashville, was offered a job working at a church. I just wanted to be the goodest good girl that ever good girled, you know, and I did everything I could to try to, you know, earn love and to be good and to earn love from the world and to belong. And, you know, it was so earnest. I had no idea that I was inherently good, you know, and I was a part of a church that said I was a broken, depraved wretch. And we sang a lot of hymns about being a broken, depraved wretch. And, you know, I inherited those words and I believed every part of it because it fit the story I already believed about myself, that something's just bad and gross and wrong with me. And so I judged.
Oh, okay. We'll embrace the storm. I love that. Producer Aaron says we're going to embrace the storm. Yes. And you know what?
A little clap from the divine.
That's right.
Ruthie is supposed to be gardening right now, and she seems to be pretty in tune.
Yeah.
Like, that sun and moon stuff. Like, has to be over her. You might as well just embrace it.
This is so true.
Y'all, all of we've it
had
belongs.
To, there's, there, for the, there is a crazy storm that we had to postpone recording for. And there's some remnants that are hanging on.
A little rumble.
Yeah.
A little rumble.
But, yeah. I mean, it's right along with our theme of, like, talking about the storm you were going through.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
So yeah, I moved to Nashville. I started working at church. I met my first boyfriend. My parents were convinced I was a lesbian. And I'm like, I wish that would be such a dream.
Wait, why were they convinced you were a lesbian?
I never dated anyone. I think a big part of it, I was raised by brothers. I felt really connected to, I had a ton of guy friends, but I didn't know how to attach. Mm. I didn't know how to let myself really be vulnerable and let myself really be seen. And so I would kind of brother every man I met. That's probably why I love gay men so much, because it felt really safe to me, because gay men aren't going to break your heart and brothers aren't going to break your heart. And so I brothered everyone. I have so many brothers that would do absolutely anything for me. And at the time I would always just say, I'm very independent, you know, but it was really because I didn't know how to attach. That was the root of that. And I just had tons of girlfriends and I loved them so much. And, you know, I was very affectionate. So met him. We got married 10 months later because we felt shame for having sex because we were the sweetest little earnest idiots that ever were. And about a year into our marriage, I started having really debilitating pain. And that's when things really took a turn because I was able to, you know, I would talk about the wreck to people because mm-hmm. I am a storyteller and I mm-hmm. love telling stories and I love a cool story.
Same.
And I got a lot of attention for it. You know, like you had this horrible wreck, you broke your neck, all the things. But I would talk about it very much in third person. Like I was talking about someone else. I could stay very disassociated when I was telling the story and not have any emotions involved. It was just a cool story to tell. And I got a lot of attention for it. And I'm an Enneagram 4 and we love feeling special. So like I have this crazy story, you know? And so I started having this crazy pain. It was so debilitating. And of course I had no understanding of the mind-body connection. I had no understanding of suppressed emotions, but there was this physiological thing going on that we didn't understand at the time, and started going to all these doctors. They'd have me do MRIs, the film would come back, there'd be this black spot on the film. They go, oh, that's just the magnet, the machine interacting with the wire from your fusion. And basically, they started me on all these therapies, nothing helped. So then they started me on narcotics. And I remember very specifically the first time I ever took a hydrocodone, and all of a sudden, because you know I never drank, I never did anything, and all of a sudden I'm like laying in this bed and I'm not having to feel all the things. I don't have to feel, you know, the pain in my body. I don't have to feel the emotions that I've been suppressing for so long. I didn't have to feel how much I didn't like myself. I didn't have to feel how, you know, numb I felt to life and how disassociated I felt. All of a sudden I just felt this like beautiful feeling. Beautiful, maybe that's not the word, but I didn't have to be here. I didn't have to play the role.
It was
of
beautiful to you at the time.
It was.
Yeah.
It felt exciting.
I think that's appropriate. I get it.
I'm like, whoa, this is awesome. And I felt like I was like melting into the bed and I didn't have to be here. And it felt incredible. And I loved it. And that started me on a journey. And I ended up, I lived in a bed for about 5 years. And at that point, they had me on the highest level of fentanyl, morphine, hydrocodone, just name it, all these drugs, because I was just losing my mind, you know, and I was in so much pain. I had no tools how to handle any of it. And I got to just lay in bed and watch reality TV and eat junk food and take drugs. And as much as I hated my life and I hated it, there was also a part of me that really loved it, if I'm being honest. If I'm being really truthful with myself, I wouldn't have ever said that or believed that even. But I didn't have to show up to a life I didn't like. I didn't have to show up to a job and a church. I didn't really believe the things. I was just doing what other people told me. You know, I hadn't had a real personal experience with the divine at that point. I didn't have to show up to a marriage, you know, as a young girl in the South. It's like, that's the end all be all.
Right.
To be chosen by someone, to have this beautiful wedding, to, you know, he's going to be the Prince Charming that's going to make your life better. And bless. Like what? Bullshit stories.
Well, we hear so much about the term of grooming right now in culture. And, it's a hot button topic, no matter what, you know, a lot of people probably just got triggered by me saying that. But, the truth is that, both you and I were groomed from a young age that like our ultimate reality or our ultimate self-actualization was going to be a spouse, getting married, having children.
Yes.
Doing all the right things.
Absolutely. And this is what's going to give you eternal life and be a good person and have, you know, totally. And of course, that's just not how it worked. And that was even more depressing. And I mean, I liked him, but I didn't know how to love myself, much less love another person. And he didn't know how to love me either. We were babies and had no tools whatsoever on how to communicate, how to, you know, repair, how to do any of this work. And so we were both just like in survival mode. Yeah. And I can't even imagine how traumatizing and painful that was for him. He was 21 when we got together. We were babies, you know, and had no tools. And so after about 5 years, a doctor said, you know, I'd gone to so many doctors at that point, but they were like, I can't tell you what's going on until I see what's under that spot. And that's when this $50 x-ray showed that the wire had pierced my brainstem. And it was like a panic moment because they were like, you shouldn't be alive. You shouldn't be walking. You know, you should be brain dead. You could die any minute. And but we have to get it out because if we don't, like all of those things, eventually one of them will happen or more than one. And it was terrifying to see.
Was this here in Nashville?
Mm-hmm. Wow. That was here in Nashville. And it was so terrifying. So I was already so unwell. Again, I'd been on drugs in a bed for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I had no tools to handle any of it. And insurance wasn't going to cover the life-saving surgery because it was a pre-existing injury.
Oh, my gosh.
And I had already left the church. I mean, I wasn't able to work at that point, obviously. Right. And so my dad was coming to see me. And he was going to tell me that he would sell our farm so that I could have the surgery because insurance wouldn't cover it. I grew up on a farm. He'd stopped to see our Amish friends on the way. And we don't know exactly what happened because no one was with him at the moment that it happened, but he fell down a flight of stairs on that stop and ended up passing of brain damage.
Oh my gosh.
I know. It was just one of those, like, you kind of can't make this shit up
kind
of things. Like, I just remember thinking, if there is a God, fuck you.
Yeah.
I felt so abandoned by life. I felt abandoned by God. I felt abandoned by my dad. I felt abandoned by life in general. Like, I just felt like I want to die. Like, I don't want to, this is like, I thought that was the worst thing that could happen to me.
Yeah.
And now you're going to take my dad too. Like, I just like, F you, F life. I don't want to be here. This is my hell. Like, I would just pray and pray and pray. If there is a God, like, let me just fall asleep and not be here anymore. Cause I am trapped in this body, in this hell, in this, these four walls. And it was beyond traumatizing at the time, you know? And something really precious that happened at the time is my godfather ended up setting up a medical fund in my dad's honor in our little town. Like, he was the educator of the town and just really loved people well as he knew how. Like, he was just of service, you know? And he'd always tell us, I love you so much. Remember your manners. Always look out for the little guy. And that was his thing. Like, notice the people that others are missing, you know, and go and do and love them and serve them. And so,
I love that.
Notice
the people that others are missing.
Yeah. And so my godfather set up this medical fund and this full amount of money was raised for me to be able to have this surgery. And so much went into it, you know, like I ended up being pursued by doctors because they like get off on being the first one to do something like love that shit. And so I ended up choosing Mayo Clinic, these top surgeons. They ended up taking bone from my other hip, removed the wire and then refused it with titanium screws. And I think this is so human. We think like this thing outside of me is the thing that can fix me. Right. So I put all my hope in the surgery to make my pain go away and to not have to deal with this anymore. So I left that surgery. I mean, it was a miracle that I was walking and brain functioning because they didn't know, like, the surgery itself could have like caused all of those things. And no one had done that surgery before because no one had ever had that injury before. So it was really, I mean, the scariest thing ever, you know, and I was obviously not well while that was all happening. But what was wild is I walked out of there, like holding the piece of wire that had, I mean, which was pretty significant, that had been in my brain with a new neck brace with more titanium, more, you know, my neck looked more like a toaster oven than a spinal cord.
Wow.
And walking, but I was actually in more pain after. I ended up getting like pretty severe nerve damage and things after. So they had me on even more narcotics when I left there, and I was in more pain. It was a different type of pain. The shooting pain had stopped, but I had like complete burning down my side. And I was so emotionally unwell after that because I felt like that was my one chance. That was my one hope. And I'm in just as much pain, if not more, now. And I'm just gonna have to live like this for the rest of my life. So I actually went back to my bed for 2 more years after that. And of course, I had never heard of 7-year cycles. I did not grow up in this world, in this type of world, you know? And at 7 years, I had one of many nervous breakdown, like a massive nervous breakdown. And I stopped sleeping. I could tell my marriage was coming to an end. He was done, and I don't blame him at all. I definitely could not show up to him as a partner. And he was very, very unwell at that time too, and had his own stuff going on. And So that began this process. I ended up having to move home. I couldn't take care of myself. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. And I, it was such a dark time. It was so traumatizing. But it was also one of the best things that ever happened to me because it began the process of changing my life.
Mm. So you went home and what changed?
Yeah, I think while I was there, they had talked about sending me to get help. Mm-hmm. And that scared me so much because, again, what did they say about you today, Ruthie?
Right.
That little girl was like the level of shame that people knew I was losing my mind. Mm-hmm. That was probably more traumatic to me that other people knew than anything. My identity, my worth, my value is in what you think of me. And mm-hmm. if you know I'm losing my mind and living in a bed and they want to send me to a treatment of some kind, I'm like, I'm going to do it on my own. So I started the process of weaning myself off of all the narcotics to prove to them mm-hmm. that I didn't need that, that it had nothing to do with the drugs, that it was just like physical pain was my problem.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, you know, that was a part of the journey and I'm so grateful I weaned myself. It took me about 4 months to wean myself off of everything, but wow. I still had no tools. I had no therapist. Yeah. I wasn't like doing the work yet to get back in my body. And that was a part of the journey, you know, but I started kind of white knuckling life. Like I remember my brother saying, babe, you can lay in your bed and hurt all the time, or you can get up and choose life and serve people and help people and hurt. And right now those are your only two options. And I was like, okay, I want to live and hurt, you know? And so that's what I started trying to do. And I mean, it's been such a journey, you know, and for so long, this part of my journey was everything I found my identity in. Like, it's a crazy story and I've barely skimmed the surface of all uh-huh. the craziness, but it felt, you know, I felt a lot of identity in this pain story. And again, Enneagram 4, we love feeling special. So I could like tell people this story and people would be like, wow, you were so brave. You were so wise. Like, I'm just in awe of all that you've lived through. And then all of a sudden I felt like I deserve to be here. I deserve a seat at this table because they think I'm special.
Well, you also, if from my perspective, it's also, I'm like hearing this parallel of like, no, you found another avenue from the one that you were taught initially, which was please everybody through performance and skinny and looks yeah. and smiling the right way and all these things. And all of a sudden now you have this story yeah. of what happened to you yes. that could accomplish that social need of connection totally. That you had
totally.
All in one practically selfless way.
Yes.
And so it makes all the sense in the world.
Oh, totally. And my new drug became Instagram because I started my first Instagram account. Mm. I started sharing my story and I got a lot of attention. I got yeah. a lot of attention and I got a lot of value. And I got a lot of people telling me how inspiring I was and how, mm. you know, in awe they were of me. And so that became a new drug. And it did its job. It did exactly what it's supposed to do. And of course, none of it's fulfilling and none of it can ultimately do the things. Mm. But I had no idea until, you know, I started sharing my story for a living and I would get up and I would talk my story for, you know, the first 50 minutes. And then the last 10 minutes, I'd be like, and there's so much hope. There's so much hope for you. But now what's been so beautiful through so many different things in the last decade, but what I love to share now is the invitation of pain and what all of this trauma and all this loss has invited me into and mm-hmm. what it's brought me home to and this deep unlearning and this deep, deep remembering and remembering that, you know, I think a huge piece of it is remembering because my body coming here as a baby, we know our bodies are good. Mm-hmm. We know that we're like, we know where we came from, the most glorious place ever. We come here knowing that. And then it's like conditioned out of us. And then we're handed a lot of conditioned stories of what's wrong with us instead mm-hmm. of what's so good and what's so right. And so I think through this journey, it's brought me back home to me, back to this body that, you know, for so long I believed hated me. Mm-hmm. I thought my body hated me. I thought my body was just something to control, to look a certain way and to be skinny and whatever story, be beautiful, to get that kind of attention. And then unlearning those stories and remembering the goodness of my body, that my body got louder and louder and louder and screamed so loud at me, because she loves me so much and all along was calling me back in to do this inner work, to learn how to feel, to learn how to commune with my parts. You know, I was told certain emotions are good, not explicitly, but just being, you know.
Oh, I think some of the strongest messages we're told are the ones that are nonverbal or that are lived out through example.
Yes.
Or, you know.
Totally. 100%.
When I look back at all of the things that I had to unlearn, the hardest things that I had to unlearn were messages that were not overtly said.
Totally. Totally. I 100% agree with that. And that shit's been handed down generation after they were handed the same bullshit.
Yep.
You know, like, you know, I remember learning about the seven core emotions, like anger, fear, sexual desire, mm-hmm. and excitement, you know, like disgust. These are like core emotions. If you come here in a body, these mm-hmm. are like ingrained in your body. But in my home, those were not allowed. I mean, joy and excitement were. Those were.
Right.
But these others were not. My dad was the only one really allowed to have anger. Disgust, like, why aren't you grateful? You know, you got to be grateful. Fear, like, I got picked on constantly because I was the scared. They said I had a case of wimpitis. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I was scared shitless. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. I did not have attunement. I did not have attachment. I was fucking terrified.
Yeah.
But that went allowed in my home. But it doesn't go away because we're told it's not allowed. We swallow it, right? And it moves into the basement and it... Like, I'm obsessed with internal family systems and
heck yeah.
It's like changed my whole life, you know, and shadow work and learning how to commune with these parts. Cause of course they're not going away. They come out sideways. Mm-hmm. They drive the bus.
Yeah.
They're gonna drive because these unconscious wounded parts are gonna be our drivers. And so it's become the foundation for living my life, for, you know, my clients is teaching parts work, teaching how to recognize, allow, inquire, feel, nurture these parts that come up. I'm like, they all are in me. I'm not a bad person because I feel anxiety and because I feel jealousy and because I feel insecurity or because I've lied and I've stolen and I've cheated and I've unconsciously used people.
Mm-hmm.
All these parts sit at my table. And because before they were unconsciously driving, I would then shame myself when I'd see those parts of me come up. You know, we so often see these parts and then we become our own second wound because we shame the shit out of ourselves, right? And then
we become our own second wound.
Yes. Because, you know, like,
I gotta let that sink in for a second. Wow. That's powerful right there.
It's just, and it's so human. We're handed this stuff, you know? I remember learning that from my friend, Dr. Hillary McBride, talking about that second arrow, because, you know, jealousy would come up and I'd be like, you're the worst friend ever. You're the worst friend ever. I cannot believe, why can't you just be grateful for your friend mm-hmm. that she has this partner or mm-hmm. grateful that they have this money or grateful that they get to have this job instead? Yeah. I'm like, what's wrong with you? And instead now, jealousy is just a message that there's something that's also brewing up in you for a longing, right? Fear, wow, this incredible message that something in you is trying to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what a great message, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Desire, sexual desire, so beautiful. Of course that doesn't go away because you're told that it's dirty or sinful, because it feels good and it's beautiful and our bodies are beautiful. You know, it's like, it's incredible, but we're taught that that's dirty and sinful. And, you know, I don't even mean this in a judgmental way. Like when I watch documentaries or I hear about, like I just watched the Hillsong documentary and
I did too.
Right. Yeah. And like, you know, preaching from the stage of sexual immorality and how dirty and sinful. And of course that's driving his bus because
mm-hmm.
because you put a ring on your finger, do you no longer have desire?
Right.
Of course you do, human.
Yep.
Of course you do. And it's not dirty and it's not bad. It's not sinful. But when we shame it and we push it down, of course that's going to move to affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Of course that's going to become abuse and all these things that have been suppressed. It's going to come out sideways or we're going to be, you know, I married my first boyfriend, I had kissed a few people. And then when I swung really far the other way and like gave my body to people that didn't honor me mm-hmm. and deserve me, mm-hmm. but because those shadow parts are gonna drive, right? And so learning how to commune with the parts of me that I have hated and shamed has been some of the most beautiful work that trauma and pain has invited me into. And learning how to embody my body. You know, I remember hearing the shaman say that knowledge is just a rumor until it moves into the muscle. And I was like, tattoo that shit on my body. Oh my God. Because I'd had two therapists tell me I didn't need to come back because I knew so much about trauma. Uh-huh. I studied so much about trauma. I could talk to therapists like a peer because I knew so much, but none of it had been embodied yet. Mm-hmm. It was all a rumor.
So how did that work for you? Like, how did you embody it?
Yeah. I mean, it's an ongoing daily practice. I can still leave my body in a heartbeat. But for me, there's a lot of things that I do to learn how to not just talk about a feeling, but to feel a feeling. And my partner and I practice this a lot. Like, he'll say, you know, or I'll say, anxiety is visiting me right now. I don't try not to say I am anxious. I don't want to claim it, but it's a part that's sitting at my table right now.
Yeah.
Like, I woke up after giving a really big talk last week and I felt an emotional hangover and I felt so much anxiety in my body. So I woke up in the morning, I was just crying and I was like, babe, anxiety is visiting me so strongly right now. And he said, oh, where do you feel it? And I was like, oh, it's in my chest and it feels like this weight and I feel so scared. I feel so scared. And he's like, is there a color? Is there a shape? Is there a sensation? What does it feel like? Is there a heat? Is there a temperature? How big is it? And then he'll say, and I love that part of you that gets to be here. And we practice this with each other and practice welcoming. All of our parts are invited. Every part of me gets to be here. And the more I love and commune with every part of me, every part of you gets to be here. Yeah. And every part of my partner gets to be here. You know, like, he's not bad when he feels these things. I'm not bad. I'm just freaking human, you know? And so learning how to feel it in my body, not just talk about anxiety, but to feel anxiety and what's in asking my body. Because, you know, I learned this again, Dr. Hiller McBride, anxiety is always just a check engine light. So we all have, you know, those seven core emotions and of course many more others. But when we learn how to not feel those aren't allowed to be here, we create inhibitory emotions, which are shame, guilt, and anxiety. And those are all emotions that keep us from feeling the core emotions. And then those tell us that I am bad, right? Something's wrong with me. But when I'm feeling shame, I'm not able to feel fear. I'm not able to feel the sadness because it's covering it up. So it's always like a check engine light. When a check engine light comes on, you know to lift the hood. There's something going on underneath the surface. So when I start feeling anxiety, I get to feel it in my body. And then I get to ask my body, body, what's underneath this? Is there a feeling underneath anxiety that wants to be felt right now that I'm scared to feel? And our bodies talk to us. They literally, we learn how through practice, because we unlearned it as a child. It was, you know, we overrode them. Like, I remember, you know, there were people I didn't feel comfortable with, but I had to go hug anyway, and I had to go sit in their lap anyway, or I'd feel like hungry in the classroom, but I had to sit there and be a good girl and smile and not get food at that point or not move my body, you know? So we get conditioned out of these things, but they're beautiful, right? So learning when I feel anxiety, fear, shame, those things, I know when I'm feeling those inhibitory emotions that there's something underneath it. So I get to inquire. That's why, like, I love TARP.
Did you say the three are anxiety, guilt,
and shame?
And shame. Okay.
Are the inhibitory emotions. Yep. But then we feel shitty feeling the inhibitory emotions. So that's why we start numbing. Right. And we can start doing it so young. I mean, I learned to just eat food and sit in front of a TV at a very young age because I don't have to feel the inhibitory emotions. And then I really don't have to feel the core emotions because something's saying I'm bad if I feel those. Right. I mean, I remember masturbating at a very, very young age, but then getting caught and feeling so much shame. And so I learned, like, my sexuality, something about that is bad and dirty. Right.
Yep.
Something about that's not okay.
Right.
I have four planets in Scorpio. I am like a very sensual, very sexual person. Are you kidding me? Like, that doesn't go away.
Yeah.
Because I'm told that that's dirty and bad, right, you know? But like trauma, pain, it invited me into doing so many, it invited me into sacred sexuality, right? It invited me into parts work. It invited me into embodiment. It invited me into doing to remembering who I was outside of my stories. Like, mm-hmm. I remember going to OnSite for the first time and I couldn't tell people what I did for a living. And because what would happen is, well, I'm a speaker. What do you speak about? I share my story. Mm-hmm. Well, what's your story? And I could give them this 5-minute elevator pitch
right.
on why I'm so amazing and all that I've lived through and how special and unique and incredible I am. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden people be like, oh, wow, right? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden I'm at this retreat and I can't tell people what I do for a living. And I was like, what the fook? What a mind fuck. Because like, who am I if I'm not this pain story?
Yeah.
Right? And so that also, just as messed up as it made me feel, it brought me to this new inquiry, which ultimately brought me to, I matter because I freaking exist. Mm-hmm. You are worthy and valuable because you freaking exist. And period, end stop. I don't have to do anything to earn that. Now my humanness comes in and I forget constantly. And then I get to remember and get to remind myself of the truer story. My little human self wants you to think I'm the most amazing, wonderful, best podcaster you've ever had in this room.
You are quite exceptional, might I say.
Thank you. But yes. Like my higher self knows it's none of my fucking business what you think of me. You know, it's none of my business because we're all just projecting and we're all just mirroring to people. So if you thought I was the worst, that really had a lot more to do with you, right? And if someone thinks I'm the best, like that's really their journey. I matter because I exist. You matter because you exist, period. And I think constantly about, everything that I've lived through. This is not me in any way, shape, or form taking away that it's been so painful. Mm-hmm. And I still live with a very, very, very high level of pain in my body. That
really?
And it kicks my ass. And this last week, like there's been days where I'm like, can I get up today? You know?
Wow.
Yeah. It's so, I don't want to in any way try to pretend as though it's like so easy. Uh-huh. You know, it is really, really incredibly hard, mm-hmm. a lot of days. And the woman that all of this pain has invited me into remembering that I am, it didn't make me a new woman. It literally peeled back the masks so that I could be the woman I always was. Mm. And I am so in love with the woman I get to be today. And the woman that I get to sit across from these incredible humans day in, day out, and mirror to them everything I know is true for them too. And I couldn't do this work. I couldn't be the version of me that lives on the planet today if all the trauma, all the loss, all the pain hadn't invited me home. And I wouldn't change it, as crazy and as insane as it is. And, literally last night, I just laid in bed and my partner just held me and I cried because there's days that it's so exhausting. It's so fucking exhausting, And wow. Like, I remember hearing this quote years ago. It says, the deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. It's a Khalil Gibran quote. And I think, that doesn't mean you just have the trauma. You have to actually commune with it. You have to feel it. Mm-hmm. You have to go back into your body because we know the body keeps the score. Every trauma we've ever lived lives in these beautiful bodies. And that's why our bodies are our gateway. We can't talk our way out of it. We have to feel it. We have to come back and learn how to calm our sweet little nervous systems that have been in fight, flight, freeze for so long, And as much pain and as much trauma and as much loss that has lived in this body, this beautiful, sweet body of mine has experienced so much goodness and so much pleasure and so much joy. And I mean, the laughter that I get to experience. I mean, I think it saved my life, honestly. And I'm pretty sure no one thinks I'm as funny as I do. Like, I laugh at me constantly and just crack my shit up.
I love constantly. That.
Yeah. And like, I think about my partner and all the trauma he's lived through and the hell, going through his addiction and getting sober. And it invited us into being these tender, soft, porous, raw beings that I'm so in love with, and I wouldn't change it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
I see there's so much emotion behind what you're sharing. And I know that when, you know, as you talk about your pain today, tears welling up in your eyes.
Yeah.
But it's not from, I don't see it being from a place of victimhood or from like, I'm curious what underneath that, when you, not when you were crying last night necessarily, but like as you tell this to me right now and it brings tears to your eyes.
Yeah.
What's behind that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's days that, when it's, you know, been a constant for 20 something years, it's exhausting. And there's days that it catches up with you, and there's days that it just kicks your ass. And this last week has been intense, and it's just gotten me, you know? And I try to have so much empathy and so much compassion, because just, you know, chronic pain sits at my table. It doesn't define me. So many friends don't even remember that I'm hurting most of the time, because I don't talk about it a ton. It's not a define. I don't talk about my pain online like I used to. It's still very real and very much a part of my life, but it's now, you know, it's not something that defines me, but it's ever present right now, you know? And so I think just what's underneath that is I don't try to hide, like, if it's really painful and it's really raw, then like I get to have that be here, and that gets to sit here. It doesn't define me, but it's a part of me, you know? And I try to invite all of my parts. And there's times like I think tears are the most beautiful release ever. It's a way that we like close loops, you know?
And yes, like, amen to that.
Yeah, they're holy. They are sacred. And it's wild that we apologize constantly for crying. That's conditioning.
Yeah.
Tears are fucking holy and sacred.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of the ways, like, we have all of these undigested feelings and thoughts that we don't have tools for to feel. And so they don't go away, they stay unprocessed. And that's why, you know, I don't believe that anyone on this planet is broken. I believe they have unprocessed trauma that caused them to freeze. Broken, fucked up things happened to them, but they were never broken. They're frozen. It's literally unprocessed trauma in their bodies. And ways that we release that is through tears, through feeling our feelings, through movement, shaking. Like, there's so many different nervous system tools, right? Through laughter, through sex, through all these different things. And so when tears come up, I let tears come up. When emotions come up, I don't try to pretend like they're not there. You know, I mean, again, Enneagram 4.
There's so much freedom and power in that.
It is. I mean, in 1 minute, I can feel, like, we were laughing a few weeks ago, my partner and I, because I'm obsessed with animals on a level I can't even describe to you. Like, my dream.
Me too. I can't, I'm not trying to compete with it and say I'm just as obsessed, but I am very obsessed as well.
Yes. I literally was like a little bit late because I feed every single animal in the neighborhood. And this,
oh gosh. Okay. You beat me.
and this like scrabby, like I call him Scabbers because he literally has scabs all over his face, but it won't let me catch him. And I feed him and he was just sitting on the porch right when I was pulling out, staring at me. And I'm like, oh, I haven't fed you today. Anyway, my dream is to have a farm with every disabled animal that ever existed on planet Earth. Like, I want a pig in a wheelchair and blind cats and deaf dogs and, you know, three-legged whatevers. Like, that is my dream. Anyway, one night we're literally laying in bed and I'm just talking to my partner and I'm just talking about all the animals we're going to save and all the animals I love and how incredible they are and how they're our teachers. And then literally, I'm not kidding, in the same breath, I start thinking about all the animal abuse and all the suffering animals get to experience and have to experience at the hands of humans that don't remember that they are consciousness. And I start crying on a level I can't even describe to you. I can barely breathe. Oh my God, just thinking about it right now makes me want to, it breaks my heart. Like,
yeah.
And I go from like the most blissed out human talking about animals to literally like bleeding out in the bed, like, like just, you know, of all the imagery and all the animals. And this is all within minutes. Like, this is my emotions. It's just, I feel it all.
My husband's an Enneagram 1, but I think he might somehow wing over to a 4. Y'all are connected in some way.
I love him. Yeah. I love us. It all belongs, you know? Yep. It all belongs.
Oh, so true.
Yeah.
What a beautiful story, and what a beautiful place that you're in and connection that you found in your own body.
Thank you
for inviting us in to... Yeah. Learn more about your process and what that's been for you.
Thank you.
It is, I believe, truly sacred.
Yeah.
And I know you believe that from the exchanges that we've had so far and getting to know you somewhat. Your work, I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
So what is it that I know that you speak and you've got a lot of people that embrace your words. And I can see why people want to listen when you have something to share. When you're a healed person and continuing to heal yourself and do the work, people are attracted to that.
Mm. Yeah. And I will be on this journey forever, you know, and I think the beauty of the work that I get to do is so much of it is shadow work, and which is loving all of our parts and honoring all of our parts. And the freedom in that is I don't have to pretend like I have it all together, because parts work is allowing your shadow to also be seen and to be witnessed and to be
what is your with. So can you explain that? What is your shadow?
Yeah. So shadows are the parts of us, the unconscious parts of us. It's our wounding. It's the parts that we learn to push down. It's the parts also that we've hated or shamed, right? So like I have so many parts at my table. I mean, joy, delight, pleasure, generosity, humor, sexuality, but I also have lied and I've cheated and I've stolen and I've used people and I've felt jealousy and I felt anxiety and I felt fear and I felt, dear God, control and, you know, perfectionism. And so the shadow parts are the parts that are like the underneath, the parts that we've suppressed, the parts that we shame, the parts that get the second arrow, right? And so learning how to recognize when we're feeling them, when we're judging someone or we're hating someone, and recognizing it, allowing that feeling to be here, not defining ourselves by it.
Yeah.
Inquiring, where we feel it in our body. These are all from Tara Brock's Rain. So recognize, allow, inquire, nurture. Inquire is when we go somatic, we feel it. Where do I feel jealousy in my body? Mm-hmm. Where do I feel fear in my body? Where do I feel judgment in my body? Whatever it is, right? And in is when we nurture it and we love on it. And learning how to do that has changed my whole life, but it's also brought freedom. Like, to be a wholehearted being is whole is all. Like, you can't just be a wholehearted being and just like the shiny, sweet, kind, pleasant parts. Like, that's bullshit, because that's not a wholehearted being. And there's so much freedom. Like, to be your freest, weirdest, freakiest, most expressive being is so loving. It's so loving to be that way in this world, because it mirrors and plants seeds for others of what's for them too.
Because
it's not mine. This is for all of us. Mm-hmm. Every part of me belongs and every part of everyone belongs. I've just remembered.
Yeah.
Right? And so I believe part of my work is to be a mirror and to help people remember that every part of them is worthy and good, that they belong, that they are an extension of the freaking divine. I am experiencing God today because I get to sit across from you. We are all these extensions of the divine, and we come here and we know that and we forget, and then we get amnesia. And I believe that the whole healing journey is just an unlearning of the conditioned stories of what's wrong with us and a deep remembering of what's so good and what's so worthy and so beautiful. It's a remembering, because our soul knows this. We are these eternal beings that come here so many times and play these different roles of different bodies. And I mean, that's my belief system, but our souls know, but then our little human selves forget. And I can forget 900 times a day, and then I get to remember again. I'll forget. I mean, literally yesterday I felt so sad. I felt so down on myself, and I was like beating myself up for a minute. And then I was like, oh, Ruthie, sweet girl, I'm so sorry that you believed those stories, but I'm here with you. I love you. And I get to speak truth to her and tell her the truer thing, right? Because my higher self knows.
Yeah.
And so that's the beauty of this work, is it's so freeing because I get to own all of my parts. So I don't have to pretend to have it all together, because I don't. I foresee myself being really human for the rest of my days and doing this work until I go back to the in-between, you know, and leave this body as Ruthie. But my work, I love it so. I think it's like, I've chosen not to have children in this life because I believe that part of my work is to be a mother on the planet to animals and to women and to, you know, trees. And I mother myself first and foremost. And I find it to be the greatest honor and privilege of my life to get to do this work. Mm-hmm. And I pray every day to be a mirror of the divine's love for, you know, I literally ask, give me your eyes, give me your words, give me your voice, give me your heart, and allow, use me, use me. And it's funny because when I was a Christian, I didn't believe any of that stuff and I didn't do any of that stuff. But now it's like literally what drives me. It's what gets me out of bed when I feel like asshole, when I'm like, it's time to get up, you know? I mean, I let myself rest a lot too, but I am a speaker. I wrote a book. I got to share my story. I get to coach, which is like, oh my gosh, I love so much. I do these 6-month containers with women. I'm about to do a women's group in the fall called the Sacred Rebel Circle.
I love that name.
Thank you. I do too. I have this deck called the Sacred Rebel deck and I am obsessed with it. I use it all the time. And I'm like, that felt so resonant to me because I believe like being our fullest expression is rebellious.
Mm-hmm.
It is a sacred rebellion to allow all of you to be here, to liberate your own body.
Mm-hmm.
To let yourself fully be you is a holy act of resistance. And I truly believe the more we do this, the more I come home to myself and I embody myself and I commune with myself, I remember that I am not separate from anything or anyone.
Yeah.
I remember the oneness, that I am not separate from this plant, from you, from animals, from beings. Like, I can't believe in an other.
Yeah.
When I remember the oneness, and that comes through coming back home into my body. Like, as wild as this sounds, I'm like, embodiment could help save the world, truly, because then I wouldn't want to pollute the world. I don't want to treat like people as just, you know, things to consume instead of just beings that are extensions of God. It changes everything.
Sure.
Everything.
Well, it's like, you know, when I realize that my arm is part of my body, I'm not going to harm my arm.
Yes.
In my right mind, you know.
Yes. Exactly.
And so, yeah.
Exactly.
And makes like, so much sense.
You know, Mother Earth, like think about like the divine. We, our bodies are an extent. I am not in nature. I am nature.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so when I learn to honor and love my body, like, I'm not going to want to, you know, use pesticides on the planet. I'm not going to want to, you know, cause more harm to my body or cause harm to my body, which is the earth, because it's an extension of me, or to your body, because liberating our own bodies is liberation for everyone. And I really believe that is my dharma on this planet, was to continue to free myself, and I'll be on this journey forever because I forget constantly and then I get to remember again. Is to bring liberation to my own body so I can mirror that liberation. I am not anyone's guru. I'm not here to save anyone. I am not here to fix anyone. That's all bullshit. No one needs fixing. We just need remembering.
Mm-hmm.
So I am here. And part of my role, I believe, on the planet is to be a mirror of that to anyone and everyone.
Yeah. Oh, I love that so much. We're going to have this in our show notes, but could you share how can people connect with you and follow along with your work?
Yes. So the best place would probably be my Substack. I have a newsletter and it's called Love's Invitation, Love's Invitation with Ruthie Lindsay, or you can go to my website, which is ruthielindsay.com, and it's S-E-Y. I also use Instagram and it's Ruthie Lindsay. And I use Substack a lot more because it's just, you know, people can read it. If they want to hear from me, they're going to hear from me. They don't have to deal with an algorithm, and and you can have longer form. And I do a lot of anyone that's a part of my Substack, I do a ton of live things for my community and have, like, we're going to do a breath work next week and I have people come in, talk about deconstruction. I have, you know, tons of different tools and things that I've needed for myself.
Awesome.
And then I also do, you can find all of this through the website, coaching and speaking and all, and lead a lot of retreats and workshops and things like that. And all of that's all listed on my website.
Lovely.
Yeah.
I love it. Thank you for sharing that information. I encourage everyone to dive in and go take a look as soon as you're done watching or listening to this episode. What's your final word of encouragement you'd like to leave for somebody that's really, you know, they're still hanging on and they're like, I'm really connected with her story.
Yeah. Oh man. Whatever you're going through right now, this is not the end of your story. You know, this quote is kind of cheesy, but I love it so much. What we thought was the tomb was always the womb. And the thing that we think is going to kill us, that will, you know, parts of us do die, but it's our conditioned parts. And the truer versions of us get to come on the other side when we do the work, when we go back in and choose the brave work of being here and being present to our own lives and feeling our feelings. It is the holiest. It is your birthright. It is for you. Whatever you're going through right now is just a deep invitation to become the truest version of you. And I also, in the same breath, want to say how sorry I am if you're suffering, because it's no joke. And this doesn't take away for how painful freaking Earth school can be. Like, I know I don't believe in hell, but I believe in hell here. I've lived in hell in this body and in my mind. But I also have known heaven. And I know there is so much goodness and so much beauty for all of us. It is our birthright. So yeah, whatever pain you're going through, it's just the deep invitation to do the most loving work for yourself.
Mm, and we invite you.
Yes. Yes.
Ruthie, thank you so much. This has been really a pleasure and honor.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here. And thank you for your really thoughtful questions and for allowing me to be here in this space and to experience the divine in you.
Yes. So there was so much purpose in this. It's meant to be.
Thank you.
So thank you. And thank you to each of you that are tuned in. I'm going to remind you, you're not an accident. Your being here with us in this space is not an accident. So thanks for listening to whatever voice that told you to press play and to stay with it. And I hope that you feel a call to action to, follow along with some of the wise words that Ruthie has shared with us today. Mm-hmm. And with that, I will close out with reminding you, I feel like I can't, and this is how I always close out the show, but it's, I stole this from somebody and it's so powerful to me. It's the best way I feel like I can always close out. But it is to say and remind everyone that it's never too late to start loving yourself.
Yes.
And you're only ever one decision away from a completely different life.
Mm. Amen. Isn't that the truth?
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.